The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
I ain't saying she a gold digger, but she ain't messing with no broke. Now I ain't saying she a gold digger, but she ain't messing with no broke.
All right, everybody, a little Kanye West for you on this Thursday. The reason why he or his past relationship with Adidas.
Wait, are you sure that was Kanye West?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Are you not? You don't.
I'm not familiar
me?
With the whole catalog. I just listened to the one record.
I have people who make sure I get it right here. Okay. Well, anyway, yes, it was. And he and his former relationship with Adidas or Adidas, depending on how you want to say it, is the cover story of the new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek, which is out on newsstands on the Bloomberg terminal at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. So let's get into it because the relationship was great while it lasted, but it's no more. So let's get into it. It's a great read. Kim Basine is our Bloomberg News reporter covering celebrity and athlete business deals, among other things. And he is here in our Interactive Broker studio along with Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber. First of all, great cover.
Yeah, we do it well every once in a while. I think this is hopefully every week, but this is one of my favorites. The story when this went down last year, we were like, holy moly, this is a huge, in sneaker world, this is a huge deal. It's like, you think about Nike and the importance of the Air Jordan and Jordan brand to Nike. Adidas, for them, they created a partnership with Ye, formerly Kanye West.
Correct.
That became Yeezy. Yeezy was a gigantic moneymaker for Adidas. And then it all came crashing down. Kim got to talk to Ye in the middle of it all. It was memorable. Great reporting throughout from him. And our mission to him was like, go give us the definitive story of what happened inside Adidas as Yeezy fell apart and their plan to go forward. How's that working out?
I think it worked out well.
Well, your plan did.
My story plan did.
The Adidas thing did not
yeah. How's it working out?
Very well at all. Yeah, so let me take you back to last September. It's the middle of the night. I get a call on my phone and a missed call and a text that says, hey, it's Ye, call me back.
Can we just sit with that for a moment?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So
bring that music back.
I call him back and we do an interview and he says...
Was it the middle of the night, right?
Like midnight on a weeknight. Okay. And and he says, you know, he wants to get out of his deals. He's done with corporate America. He wants to go out and just do it alone. And 3 days later, he sends a letter to Gap saying, you know, stop selling my stuff. I want out of this deal. That Gap deal falls apart shortly after. He starts saying more and more crazier things. And went on some anti-Semitic rants
really
toxic things, and eventually the Adidas partnership fell apart as well.
Kim, what do you think happened to Kanye, which is, by the way, separate from your story? Your story is really about Adidas, the history of the shoemaker, how they lost it versus Nike, and what they're trying to do to turn it around. But because I hear stories about Kanye being so cool. Like Danny McBride says, you know, Kanye just called him up and they started hanging out and it was fun. And he was a good guy. But the stuff that he said is not good. So what happened to that guy?
It is not good. I don't know what happened to that guy. So on the phone, he literally asked me, "Do I sound crazy?" And at that time, no, he did not. He did not sound crazy. He spent a few seconds waiting to answer a question, really think about it, and like kind of deliver a bar back to me. So like that interview, he did not sound like he did when he went to the TMZ newsroom back in 2018 and went on this long rant about how slavery was a choice. He did not do any of that. But then, you know, a couple weeks later, we're starting to go again. He just starts saying these things. When you go back in during his time at Adidas, designers will say that he was inspirational at times. But as they learned more, they spent more time with him, they started to complain about all the types of, you know, the more totalitarian ways that he ran his design studio.
What this really gets to, I think, Matt, is if you're Adidas and you're looking to, you know, make some money in the shoe business, you got a chip on your shoulder about missing out on that Jordan guy once upon a time. Yeezy existed slightly before Adidas, worth mentioning. Nike actually did a little moment where Nike was making Yeezy, which are some of the most coveted shoes in sneakerdom.
But Air Yeezy, right?
So the Yeezy thing, Adidas hit it. And what it really shows is like the reputational risk. And like we, hopefully this gets taught in business schools, right? This story, because the reputational risk is like you attach yourself to Kanye, and wherever Kanye goes, you go too. And when Kanye goes off the cliff, your brand is now going with them too, right? So,
well, especially if you put all your eggs in one basket.
And so that was the most amazing part of this, as this reporting bore out. As much as 40% of the profits at the company.
40%. It was 8% of revenue and around 40% of profits, as according to Morgan Stanley.
So that is a gigantic Yeezy-shaped hole. And the challenge that we had for Kim and Tim on the byline, Tim Lowe, also in Germany, was, okay, what's the plan to fix it? So now that they have this hole, what are they going to do about it?
What is the plan to fix it? The most immediate problem before they can do any of that is that they have $1.3 billion worth of Yeezys sitting in warehouses
around the world.
That is nuts. $1.3 billion of sneakers.
Of sneakers.
So wait, why not just unstitch the logo?
Because can you imagine the amount of manpower that would take?
So wait, don't
individually unstitching every little Yeezy
logo. But they thought about it.
They thought about burning it. Donating them to
refugees.
Victims of
that
disaster.
Would be sweet. That,
chopping them up.
Chopping them up and turning them into fields. So like the turf on a soccer field is made out of little.
So these are all
bits.
Real things.
Don't you
want to
be in that meeting? It's like, okay, can you walk us through the options of what we can do here?
But the most interesting, I think, was the donating them makes a lot of sense and would be amazing, right? You've got refugees or people that are hit by natural disasters. They need shoes. But the problem that they found was what? There could be too much trafficking.
You'd probably sell this. They're worth $200, $300, $400 American dollars.
I'm sure a refugee would love $400.
I'm sure they would love $400 American dollars. So would Adidas. Yeah. Is what they landed on, right? So now they're going to sell the shoes. Beginning May 31st, they're going to start selling this huge stockpile. A $1 billion stockpile of Yeezys, and they say they will donate a portion of the proceeds to charity.
And what happens to the money that Yeezy
used to generate?
Kanye would get. There's a little, yeah, exactly. So walk through the deal because this is really interesting, right? Like part of this, the way this deal was structured was that Kanye gets a portion of the revenue of every shoe that's sold, right?
Right, and that was a big part of the original deal that he signed. Nike would not give him royalties on the Air Yeezys.
Because he wasn't an athlete.
He said he was an athlete. I am a performance athlete. I play one on no one on stage in Madison Square Garden, is what he said.
I saw his point, by the way. I buy that. I think he is. He's a performer for sure.
Yeah, totally. You know? But they wouldn't give him that deal. Right. Adidas would.
Right.
So now he makes an 11% royalty on this. And those shoes that were made during the time, they probably do have to pay Kanye his cut. It's
fair enough.
Yeah.
So what does Adidas do or Adidas do going forward, right? They obviously have a big hole to fill.
There's been some churn in that
time
too, right?
There's been a lot of churn.
So what happened in the boardroom?
Yeah, at the top level here. So Bjorn Golden is their new CEO. He comes over from Puma at the start of the year.
Can we have a sidebar?
Yeah.
Because, wow, the Adidas Puma thing, if you didn't know this,
love each other, right?
No, they do
not. I know.
You have to go back to the World War II. This goes back to World War II.
And two brothers who fell out.
Nazis.
And Nazi brothers who fell out.
Well, everybody in the country at that point was a Nazi. I mean, like, you had to join the party or else they would shoot you. So,
the history is incredible.
Yeah.
One of them went to war. One of them stayed home to run the factory. They came back. They had a bitter feud. They split their company, and they opened two sneaker empires across the road from each other in the same small town in Bavaria.
By the way, did you watch Das Wunder von Bern?
I did not.
Great movie. A great movie.
Wow. Did not see that coming, but okay.
About Adi Dassler making the first exchangeable spikes for the German national team after... You know, they'd lost the war and they'd lost their, you know, any kind of national pride. And then they actually came up and won a World Cup. I think it was in 1950. And it was the first time they've ever had spikes that could be changed for different grass conditions. So he was like an innovator as well.
Did they win?
They won.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the other sidebar, guys.
Yeah.
But Puma, it's interesting that they bring a leader from Puma. Another leader from Puma runs Harley-Davidson right now. Jochen Seitz used to run Puma. But now they've brought this new guy because Carsten Rohrstedt, he like screwed everything up.
It was a tough period. And at the beginning, it seemed like he was on to something, right? He came in, did a bunch of cost cutting.
E-commerce. It's a thing.
E-commerce, big,
people,
you know.
People like to buy online.
You know, people do love to buy things on the information superhighway.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's crazy. Over time, you know, product cycles started to go out of whack. And as other things failed, then Ye's business within Adidas became a larger and larger piece of the profit pie.
So do they pursue, can they pursue something akin to what they had with Ye? Or is there, I don't know, like, how are they thinking about their way forward? They have product. I mean, I have a young daughter. She was wearing Adidas sneakers at one point. They go back.
But you weren't paying like a $500 pair of Yeezys, were you?
No, that wasn't happening.
They're very expensive.
But I'm just saying, so what is the way forward here?
Yeah, the new CEO says you can't replace it with just one thing. And Adidas has this habit of just going back to its oldest stuff again and again and again, just changing a little bit, updating it, new colors, new...
To their credit, sometimes it's really worked.
And it has worked many, many times. Yeah. Like, over the years, you bring back Stan Smiths, you bring back Superstars, you bring back...
Sambas,
you bring back Gazelles. These are all designs whose origins are all the way back in the 60s and 70s. This is like before Nike existed, those shoes in the 60s were made. Nike didn't come out until the 70s and wasn't really a factor until on the global stage until Jordan in 84.
And so the back to the vault, though, what does that look like in this version of it from what we can tell so far?
Sambas first, right? Sambas seem to be hot right now. The new CEO says he wants to be quicker to latch on to trends, and they've identified the Samba as what they need to go toward at this moment. So they're asking for more product from factories in Asia and getting that into stores as quickly as they can.
And it also looks a little bit like maybe playing into some sports that people have forgotten about too, that Adidas was once known for, like wrestling, boxing, etc.
They like the specialty stuff for certain sports. When these aren't enormous, it's not a $1 billion business in boxing, right? But it's certainly something that you can capitalize
and
on.
And Muhammad Ali wore Adidas.
Exactly.
He did. Oh, yeah.
Has Ye called you since the story came out?
He has not talked to me for several months, no.
He's ghosted, right? He hasn't really been seen or talked about or talked to almost anybody.
Anyone, right? He's pretty much out of the public eye. You'll see him in the tabloids every once in a while in L.A., just some photos of him, but he hasn't been speaking too often to the press lately.
He's a recluse now.
Would you want to ask, what would you ask him, though, at this point?
Oh, my.
After all this reporting you've done.
I want to know, like, have his opinions changed at all? There was apparently a report.
He made a lot of money off of this. Right? His deal?
At the very beginning, when he called me and told me that he wanted out of these deals and wanted to go it alone, right? I don't know how much of that I truly believed he was going to do. Because I knew, I've seen the I've seen the documents on this. He was making nearly $200 million a year in royalties off of this. And you're just going to throw that away?
Yeah.
Seems like it.
Amazing.
Well, according to him, didn't need him, right?
According to him, yeah.
Yeah. So...
I feel like that's to his credit, right? If you can really stand up and say, I don't need these corporate shackles, even if it's $200 million a year and you can throw them off, that's amazing. But if you then...
It's a big but.
...sort of like turn into this like racist, anti-Semitic spokesperson, that's not cool.
There's a few things we need to figure out. Incredible piece of reporting. Really great read. Kim Basine, celebrities and athletes reporter at Bloomberg News. It's the cover story of the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week. Joining us along with the editor, Jill Weber, here in studio. Check it out. Great for the upcoming holiday read.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right. Zoom was certainly an indication of how we were working during the pandemic, but we've really leaned on the team over at Microsoft 365 for how we are working, yes, then, but also today. And they've got a new report out that finds that there's not necessarily any need to be worried about AI. Of course, to be fair, Microsoft is deep into AI, really awakening the world earlier this year with its $10 billion investment into OpenAI's ChatGPT. So even so, our next guest is here to help answer the question, will AI fail? Work. And great to have back with us Jared Spataro. He is Corporate VP of Modern Work and Business Applications at Microsoft 365. Once again on Zoom in Redmond, Washington. Jared, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Great to be back with you, Carol.
Yeah, great to have you here with us. So tell us about this inquiry into AI. What you guys, I mean, the question is, I've got the report in front of me. Will AI fix work? And I think everybody's trying to figure it out. I kind of can't wait because I think it can be an assist in my job. But tell us about what you looked into, questions you asked, and who you talked to.
You bet. Let's look at what's broken first. So this particular survey is our annual survey, 31,000 people across 31 countries. And the first number that popped out to me is exactly that fix that's needed. 64% of people who responded told us that they just don't have the time or energy to get their jobs done. And we thought that that was really interesting. Coming out of the pandemic, people are tired, but it seemed to be more than that. So we combine that with our telemetry data. This is the cloud data where we see how people are working, what they're up to. We found that up to about 60% of the average worker's day is spent communicating and coordinating. Only 40% is kind of spent on that day job, the thing that they're supposed to provide to the organization. So really interesting setup right now as people are feeling tired and for good reason.
And Jared, something that strikes me anytime I talk to anyone, they're always concerned about when it comes to AI, maybe they could potentially be replaced when it comes to their job. But looking at your study, it's interesting as far as how AI is poised to create this whole new way of working. What would be the counter to that and the benefits of AI where you might not necessarily be losing your job and could actually assist you?
Well, we'll start with the fear. There's still a little bit of fear there. Almost 50%, it was 49% of people who responded told us that they were afraid that AI would come and take their job. But that was overshadowed by another number. A whopping 70% told us that despite that fear, they actually would outsource everything they could to an AI assistant just to help them relieve the burden. So there's this sense that their optimism, or at least their need for help, for AI-based help, really outweighs their fears. And that's a pretty interesting nuance on many of the headlines that we've been hearing for the last couple of months.
Well, I'm thinking about email alone. I mean, I'm going to be quite honest with you. There's a ton of email that I never even get to read because it's just a ton of stuff that people are either pitching or research. And I definitely have figured out ways to kind of weed through, do certain searches so that I really make sure I don't miss some of the important stuff. But how could AI ultimately help us in filtering through what is dumped into our email boxes on a regular basis?
Well, many of your listeners are probably familiar with ChatGPT introduced last year, and it's particularly good at summarizing. And so I've been using a product that we call Copilot, Microsoft 365 Copilot. It essentially takes the models behind ChatGPT, these large language models, and integrates it directly into your email, into Outlook. And this does amazing things. It allows you to, for instance, get a long, those long email threads where you're supposed to go read from the bottom up, and it can summarize that just in one click. And then once it's summarized, it actually gives you a couple of different prompts, or those are different things you can choose from to answer. So it will author an answer, allow you to make it longer, shorter, more formal, more casual. It has changed the way I do email. I never want to do email without it again. So it definitely changes work habits and practices.
Well, so just share with me, because like I said at the top, I mean, to be fair, you guys are all in on AI, no doubt about it. And in many ways, that news of the Microsoft investment really did kind of wake up the world in terms of what you folks were doing specifically. And now everybody's talking about it. As you guys have been playing around with it, what are you finding are the great capabilities? What are still the things that need to be worked out?
The 5 seconds to wow type demo I do with customers is in a meeting. So in a meeting like this, that would be just a normal business meeting, we're trading kind of conversation back and forward. And what it can do there is it can literally listen in as if it were an assistant to the meeting and summarize. That means it can write notes. It can respond when I ask questions like, what did Carol say again? Or how did Jared answer this question? It can allow me, for instance, to identify, you know, what are the two sides of this argument and who's in favor of which one? It actually is incredibly valuable in a meeting. And then even better than that, Carol, the thing that I love is It allows me to not attend meetings. So I can not attend a meeting and then using that same GPT large language model, query the meeting after the fact. Did they ever mention my name? Were any decisions made? What decisions? Why did they make them? So it opens up these brand new possibilities for work because it kind of blurs time and space. You know, it's as if you could be there, but you're not there. And you're able to use the power of AI here to kind of get into the dynamics of people even just having regular conversations. So just one example, but it's integrated across all of our products. We talked about email,
right.
Word, Excel, PowerPoint, all of those things.
What's the thing, though, that is still tricky? Because we talk about AI kind of working alongside of us. And if we don't have to go to the meeting, yay-hoo. But I do wonder, what are the things that, you know, people say you can't really, you know, duplicate a human in terms of their perception of things and so on and so forth. So what would you say that we still need to be cautious about, or we're still figuring out, or you guys are still figuring out when it comes to this?
Very astute question, because it turns out while these things are incredibly useful, they do make mistakes. And these things, I mean the AI assistants that we have, so they get it wrong sometimes. Mm-hmm. In fact, the technical term is hallucination, if you believe that.
Right.
That literally is the technical term. They make stuff up. So the reason that we use Copilot as a name for our product is really to signal to the user, hey, this isn't autopilot. You can't just take the answers and say, there you go, I'm going to fire this off as an email. You really have to be in the driver's seat. You have to make the decisions. But the great news is, my experience has been, when it is wrong, it's what we call usefully wrong. So it doesn't just make things up to make things up. It sometimes will fill in details where it didn't have all the data. You can go in and correct that, tweak that, and then it's put you ahead of the game anyway.
So how long do you think this could take before it's more widespread with users that could potentially use this type of things in meetings, when you do have still some of these hiccups and glitches that could happen with AI?
We just introduced a couple of weeks ago that we're expanding what we call our preview program to 600 enterprises around the world. So we'll have hundreds of thousands of users here in the coming months. So that's kind of the scale that it's at right now, but it's moving very quickly. On my team, we talk about AI time. The cycle time of the industry has really increased as we're able to build on top of these technologies really quickly. So I don't think it'll be a matter of years. I do think it'll be a matter of months until you start to see these tools being used all over the place.
You know, for someone who has been, you know, focusing on workplace trends and coming off a really crazy period, you know, meaning the pandemic specifically, and we're able to track a lot of things, how are you kind of placing generative AI, machine learning, in kind of, I don't know, is it akin to some other great or interesting development in terms of how we work? Like, how do you position it historically or technologically, for that matter?
We think it's as big as the PC revolution or as big as the internet. We think it's that big. You know, if I again frame it, we would say, wow, you couldn't write a script like this if you were trying. Really, what the pandemic did is rewire the where and the when of work. So it changed entirely around the world, you know, those two dimensions of work. All of a sudden, AI is changing the how of work. By the time we get kind of roughly 4 years out from the pandemic, the combination of those two things will have really just changed patterns, practices associated with work. My kids, as they go to work, they're not going to enter a work environment anything like I did, you know, 25 years ago.
Is that good or bad? Bottom line, because, you know, things are never, right, black and white. Like, it's
that's right.
We're worried about people not really talking to each other. I have a colleague, that's Matt, right, Miller, who laughs that when we all get on a Zoom call and we're literally like right next to each other. But I'm sitting there typing, you know, notes, and, you know, it's just interesting.
My response to that is, I would say, you know, AI giveth and AI taketh away. Like, we have this moment, and the way we think about it is, what have we gained? and what have we lost, and how do we lose as little as possible, and how do we gain as much as possible? But you're exactly right. These big, if it's as big as the PC, you know, if you really believe that it's that type of shift, then you do have to recognize, wow, this is probably the beginning of an era, a new era. We should be really thoughtful about what we want to make sure we don't lose in that process. But that will take all of us. You know, we're all learning as we go.
Yeah, right. And the more we use it, though, right, the smarter or more specific it becomes. Jared, nice to check in with you again. Jared Spataro, he's Corporate Vice President, Head of Modern Work at Microsoft 365, on Zoom from Redmond, Washington.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
So our next guest works with many Fortune 100 companies around the globe, working with them on HR programs. We're talking about health, wellness, wealth programs. She's got a great vantage point, her company does too, in terms of what's going on in the overall business and IT environment. So great to have back with us the Chief Financial Officer of the publicly held Alight, Katie Rooney, with us in studio. It really is great to have you here. I said to you, it's like not been that long, but it feels like because every day is so dense. How are you?
You know, it's been a crazy crazy quarter. Although I feel like within a light years, it's normal.
It's so true. It's true. Like our perspective has changed. Let's just start broad and macro. Talk to us a little bit about the business environment, because you do have a great window. And forgive me for those who don't know exactly what you're doing. You do work globally. You're working with lots of companies. Remind our audience what you do.
Yes, of course. So we serve 36 million people across the globe. Doing basically human capital around health, well-being, payroll. And so
these are types of programs that companies have, right?
Absolutely. When you think about employee well-being, everything we're trying to do for the employee in today's day and age, given everything we're seeing, we are taking a different approach across the industry to say, we have to engage with people differently to help drive a different outcome. We've done that a lot for clients. We've done that a lot kind of in the front office. We really haven't done that for our talent. And so we're trying to take a platform approach with Alight Work Life, where it's one place to go, where we can help you basically solve more complex issues to keep for the employer and the employee, to keep them financially secure and healthy.
Katie, do you feel like post-pandemic that employees, companies are looking at their workers differently? Or do you feel like because it's a tight labor force that maybe companies are looking at their workers differently?
Honestly, I think either way you look at it.
Or yes, yes, or no, no.
It is. I mean, it's a little bit of yes, yes. I think you have to. We did a global mindset survey and we said 80% of workers say they feel moderate to high levels of stress. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, the pandemic, if it's macro economy, there's so much in our environment today that I think employers have to play a different role in terms of how they're helping their employees.
Well, you've been in this role for 6 years-ish?
A little bit longer.
I'm so sorry.
Because Alight actually carved out in 2017 from Aon. So okay. I've been technically with the legacy company a little longer.
And so I'm curious about how you've seen employee demands change over the course of your tenure there. What would you say is the single biggest shift in the ask from employees?
Honestly, I think they found a voice. I just think we didn't, you know, and again, I've, you know, as an employer, I'm not sure we took the time to listen. And I think employees have now found a stronger voice that it starts with they're leaving, right? Higher turnover, they're requesting more. And so we have to help them in a different way. I don't think it's one specific thing. I just think when you think about overall well-being, what they're feeling, what they're seeing, we have to take a different approach, hear them, and support them in a different way. They want to build trust with their employer. It's got to be a two-way street, whereas historically I think it was a little bit more one way.
Well, when it comes to like what the services that you guys provide for your clients. So I said health, wealth, and wellness, right? Did I catch them all?
Yeah.
So what is it, where are you seeing the most growth or more demand that like, this is what my employees want? Or is it everything?
I think it's interconnected. I think that's the important thing. It for the employee, again, think about it. Think about what you potentially do today just to figure out where your paycheck is and where your health coverage is and where your 401k coverage is. How many systems are you going to? Where are you going, right? And how do you know what to use, right? And what the right decisions are? We say, should you be investing in your HSA, a health savings account, or your 401k? Like, those are actually complex questions that we really haven't helped our employees answer. And so I think it's more the combination of all of them to help people make a better decision. You got a pay raise. What should you do? Right? Of course, yes, you want to make a different decision, but bring it all together for them.
Well, how does AI and generative AI change this? Because I do think about the question, the conversation I could have with a system, a platform that is integrated, but it seems like it could make it so much easier to use, right?
I love that question because I think there's so much opportunity. It starts with the data.
Yeah.
So think about it. There's a million searches today on Google for a doctor. Where do I find a doctor? Do you think Google knows what health plan you're in, what's in network, where you're located, who's the highest quality, lowest cost, right? And helps you make a decision and can schedule an appointment and get you a second opinion.
Right?
So like you need the AI in terms of the underlying data to help drive those personalized recommendations. But it has to be, when you think about in a trusted source, who has access to that.
So how do you do that? So how do you make it comprehensive, smart, accurate, right, and then secure?
Are you working on it?
We
start there today. I mean, security is table stakes.
Yeah.
I mean, that just, you can't have an employee concerned or thinking about that. We spend a ton of time, resources, money on that, like full stop. Put that aside, then the next piece is why we think this integrated platform is important. We know your pay. We know your claims history. We know how you're saving. A mom just had a baby. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they might have a different need than somebody who's retiring. So I think it's more about taking that data to use, kind of provide a recommendation engine of one, because everyone's unique.
Right, exactly.
That's the power of it.
Okay.
Is there risk at all on decreased jobs because of the AI impact? I know that's like the basic obvious question, but how are you thinking about it?
I just think it's different. Again, AI is only as good as the data, but it's not going to drive a decision. So, you know, we have people calling us because they need to check the status of it. They don't need to call us for that. Like, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But listen, if somebody has a cancer diagnosis, they want to talk to someone.
Right.
That's never going to go away. So I think it's more that jobs are changing, and we, I think, have a social responsibility to figure that out. And hopefully, I mean, in the finance function in particular, I think that's a huge opportunity to play a bigger role strategically in the business.
Because, you know, I think about the services that you offer, and I even think about my own experience with, and we have a company with incredible benefits, and we do have some really great usable programs and so on. But I do think about if Matt Miller was here, another one of our TV and radio anchors, he'll go on and on about like the chatbots and how they drive him crazy when you're on a site. And he's not wrong sometimes, where I just want to get on with the human and say, help me out here, walk me through it. And so there is this balance.
There's a balance.
But there's also other times where I love it, where I can just kind of whittle through a bunch of information and figure it out.
There are times you don't want to talk to someone.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? And it's, you know, I have a mental health issue. I just need to figure out where to go. I don't want to have that conversation yet. Just direct me. At the same time, okay, now I have a diagnosis. Tell me what this means, right? So I think you just have to meet people where they are.
Is, though, chat or generative AI a big boost for what you guys ultimately do? Like, do you see that as a big growth driver?
I think it's a huge opportunity. And it's not just generative AI. It's AI more broadly.
Because you're already using that AI, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we have to be, right? When you think about, I think about it, there's predictive, there's generative, there's just, in essence, driving an informed decision for someone, it will only continue to get better.
So then what do you say to, and we're got about a minute and then we'll come back and talk some more, but there is this kind of wait, I'm terrified by it. And I'm also like, well, wait, we've been using it for a long time already. So how do you, you know, what would you be saying to someone who was asking you like, oh my God, what is this?
I mean, I love the analogy someone told me the other day. I'm in finance. You know, the calculator came along. It's not like all the finance jobs went away, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's just, we have to just think differently. Mm-hmm. Even with generative AI, at the end of the day, there's still a judgment call. So I think it's changing that mindset around how we benefit and use it in a more proactive way.
Yeah, I just think it's, yeah. And I love that you're being smart about it and very specific and just saying, technology can be so terrifying, right? I feel like, and people have kind of run in that direction. And I think there's been some great reporting showing how it can go astray. But there's also a potential, if you think about online when it all started, right? Or the internet. I think
there's always, and I think it's exciting. Like this next chapter,
we
I think
always
is so
worry
exciting.
Every time, and then it's right. fine. You know, it's always fun.
Yeah, and we just have to learn as we go along.
We do.
We're talking with the CFO of Alight, Katie Rooney, here in our studio. I want to go back to some business stuff. Is it easy being a CFO right now? Especially when we talk about credit crunches, markets tightening, questions about recessions and slowdowns.
I don't know that I'd say easy or hard. I think it's a really important time to be a CFO. There's so much.
When hasn't it been important in
well,
the last 13, 14 years?
Well, I think that's fair. I think that's a fair
Sorry.
Point. No, it's a fair point. But in terms of the magnitude of risk and volatility.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, we spend a lot of time focusing on balance sheet, right? Having kind of that visibility into revenue, profitability, cash flow, so that we can weather any scenario, right? Mm-hmm. Because I think... even over the past couple of years, right? With COVID, with everything we've been through, there's just been so much more volatility and uncertainty that you have to have a bigger role in managing through that.
Do you feel more uncertain about the outlook? Do you think more about recession based on things that you're seeing or conversations? Because you do have a great, as I said at the top, like a great window because you talked, you have so many corporate clients.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, I mean, the good news is for us, it's an opportunity because we do serve, you know, 50% of the Fortune 500. They are focusing more on cost. We can help address a bigger need when you think about the solutions we can provide.
So they'll
I think
do
that
the
helps.
Spend?
Yeah. I mean, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, you're going to provide healthcare. You're going to do payroll, right? And actually, we can help provide a better solution to maximize how you're using those services. So I think the conversation doesn't change. I think it's more... I actually think about it as how do you make it an opportunity where we can actually invest more during this cycle to get ahead? Because we are coming at it from a position of strength.
So what do you look at when making that decision?
Yeah, I mean, I think it starts with just healthy balance sheet, right? Yeah. Having that flexibility to weather different scenarios. So, and being thoughtful about what those could look like.
Mm-hmm. Katie, did you see any impact from the collapse of like Silicon Valley and the four regional banks? Did that in any way... I don't know. I'm just curious the impact.
We really didn't.
Okay.
You know, and I think just how quickly the government stepped in, I think, you know, that supported so many different companies. So we really didn't. But you had to be prepared in case, right? We serve companies that have payroll with those banks. Like, how do you make
That's
sure...
That's what I was thinking along the line. Right?
You're prepared and you can step in and help your clients. Like, this moment of need is for our clients, right? Mm-hmm. If we can step in and be that trusted resource, like, it builds such goodwill in other macro environments. So I think that's the opportunity.
So can we talk about working from home? We just did talk about retail and real estate and some of the cities. We see it outside our door of some retail that still hasn't come back post-pandemic. One of the things I loved when we have talked in the past is you said how you were flying all your workers in for a week, right?
Yeah. I think...
Are you still doing that?
We do. I think... Again, this is what works for me, particularly in finance. Quarter end is such an important time. And we still need development. We still need face-to-face time. But trying to get people there one day a week or two, like one day a week, you spend that day just catching up with everyone.
Yeah.
Like it's not, which is great. But if you do it a week.
But not productive.
It's not terribly productive, right? So we need a full week. It's 1 week. We're committed. We're all together. We do lunches together. We go out together. So there's, you know, work hard, play hard. We kind of get that balance in. I think it builds a lot of camaraderie for the team. Yeah. And honestly, it helps develop the team, which I think is so critical.
So you're still doing that. So they'll be home for like 3 weeks and then they come in for a week.
And I wonder if you see, to the extent that you can talk about this, a gender impact on that, because the thing that I worry about so much is that when you force people, push people back to work, a lot of women are staying at home still. They're the ones taking advantage of the work from home capabilities of companies, and that freaks me out, you know?
Yeah, no, I get it. And but I think that's why this strategy works for us, because they can plan.
Yeah,
I can plan for 1 week. It's hard when it's one, you know, it's hard to find childcare for 1 day a week, 2 days a week. So that, again, that's what's worked for us. There, I do have people who come in a lot more. I love it. I'm in a lot more. That works for me. So I think it's just trying to get that balance right.
What about the tightness of the labor force? What are you seeing on that front? Is it easing at all? If you're hiring and you're looking?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's it's easing dramatically. I think, though, that... the conversation is changing in terms of what employees want. So it used to be, you know, I can only find someone who would work from home in this location. I think because we've grown more flexible in terms of the talent pool, in terms of the skill set we're looking for, we want more diverse skill sets. I think that's helping.
Yeah.
But it's still, I know it's still a tough market.
And people still want to work from home.
They do. Absolutely.
So what do you say to the debate? Because it does seem, I mean, it's still out there and we're still trying to figure it out. And we certainly hear from CEOs who I think from the pandemic initially were like, yeah, we're going to be flexible. And then they're like, no, we're not flexible anymore. So what is the reality of it? Are we still trying to figure it out?
I think the reality is we have to find some time for people to be in the office. But it has to be meaningful. I don't need people coming into the office to sit in a cube all day and be on Zoom calls. So I think, but we need training programs, we need mentorship, we need team building, we need, so I think it's making those in-person experiences meaningful and having enough of them, you know. I think that's what matters.
We've got like a minute and a half in our final minutes with you. You're a woman who's a CFO. I hate to do that whole thing, but just meeting you and how cool you are, can you talk about any advice you have for other women that are in male-dominated roles?
Because was it easy getting here?
Yeah. It was not easy. I think you have to be true to yourself. I got pushed a lot in times in my career. Have a stronger voice. Be louder. Do this. That wouldn't have worked for me.
Oh, interesting.
And so I think I do have a strong voice when I need to. I won't be the loudest in the room. But I know you have to figure out how to influence in your own way to drive progress and drive change. And I think being comfortable with that is really important, because then you can develop that confidence to succeed in any environment. And find the right support network. I mean, men and women, it's incredibly powerful.
That's so really glad. Cool.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. Yeah. But the whole concept of, because I think there was for a while, like, you know, you got to be strong.
Lean in.
Do this.
Yeah.
Lean in. And I think you do.
And
have
at times
to be,
you do. But
yes. But you also have to be true to yourself.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. We know you had a busy trek while you were here in New York and you found some time for us. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.
As always, safe travels back home. Just so glad to kind of cover so much with you. Katie Rooney, CFO, Chief Financial Officer at Alight. Thank you so much. Alight Solutions here in our Interactive Brokers studio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Fight the powers that be. Fight the power. Fight the power. Fight the power.
All right, they're definitely... fighting the fight, if you will, and we'll get into exactly what they're doing. Especially if you head out west to the University of California at Berkeley, you will find a class called the Berkeley Citizen Clinic. And in it, students are learning how to fight hackers and help non-governmental organizations. We're talking about the NGOs really better protect themselves. This story is in the upcoming new double issue of Bloomberg Business Week on newsstands later this week, already online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and on the Bloomberg. So let's get to it. Bloomberg News cybersecurity reporter Margie Murphy on Zoom in San Francisco, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber, right here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Joel, this clinic, the first of its kind in the country, I'm just curious how this story got the green light. What was the pitch?
I just thought it was so interesting because we're always interested in what's happening in the cybersecurity world. And this was just an effort that I hadn't heard about. And yet students are doing cool stuff. And this the Traverse Project, when I first even read about it in the story, just was like, wow, they're doing something that I had not been aware of before this Travis project. I hadn't been aware of what they were doing, but what they're doing is actually, you know, draws attention from people that aren't exactly, like, you know, doing good stuff in the world.
Right.
And so the Berkeley Citizen Clinic comes in there, and this is a pro bono effort, and it has a little bit of a feel good quality. But what I'm really curious about is what happens in the classroom to lock this stuff down, Margie. So let's start actually Traverse Project. What are they doing, this nonprofit, and why does that draw the attention of the bad people in the world?
Yeah, absolutely. So I talked to Austin Shamlin, who is the founder of the Traverse Project, and he spent many years working in the kind of anti-human trafficking industry, I guess you could call it. And he's set up this nonprofit, and what it is, it's a tech company, really, and they provide technology to law enforcement around the world. And so they, you know, they have a special proprietary technology, which, you know, it's kind of their secret sauce. And they're helping find the bad guys, the people who are supplying women from Ukraine, who are trying to get over to Poland, sending them to brothels around Eastern Europe. And he's helping with this tracking technology.
Oh, a little bit of a freeze here. We'll see if we can. Oh, are you there, Margie?
I'm here.
Okay,
I'm
great.
Sorry.
No. Technology, it happens. Go ahead and pick up, please. Go ahead.
So Austin is, you know, for this, his human trafficking technology company, he's helping track down the people who are moving women and children around the world, often for sex trafficking. And so he's attracting the ire of some really bad people. And all the money that he's getting to fund his company, it's going into the technology that he's providing to help with this effort. And he doesn't have the budget to spend it on actually securing himself and his volunteers and his employees, who are kind of putting themselves on the front line against criminal gangs, you know, potential moles in the law enforcement themselves. So he although he's working in tech, he doesn't have the budget to go and get a consultant to kind of show him where all the vulnerabilities may be every time he speaks to a volunteer, talk about, you know, where there could be people who might be in their networks watching what they're doing, trying to get a step ahead of them. So he heard about this clinic at Berkeley, and now this fall will get about 15 students who are going to help him draw up a cybersecurity plan, tell him kind of the best ways for him to communicate with his volunteers and with the partners that they have all around the world to make sure that they can continue doing what they need to do in a safe manner, and not putting their volunteers at risk.
So what's the backstory at Berkeley? Where did this program come from?
Right. So it all came from there's a program which is like the public interest cybersecurity program. And that was a module that cybersecurity students could teach. And Sarah Powerzak at Berkeley has been kind of spearheading that. And they thought, you know, often these universities do have a bit of a pro bono effort, and they look around in their community and think, you know, how can we be helpful? And they realized that a lot of these students were going on to work with like large companies with huge sums of money, and they were never going on to help kind of work with the smaller organizations around them, or the NGOs and nonprofits that they felt really needed the help, the help securing themselves. And so they started off by, I think they did a couple of local like women's health clinics, anti-abortion clinics, and then they started getting more interest, and they realize this is like an international thing. And so now they've been doing it for about, I think it's like 4 years now. And now they have to screen for the clients that they have come in, and they make sure that they're going for the kind of lowest budget but high risk clients.
Margie, you know, one thing I think is interesting too, and we have so many conversations where when you talk to the head of a company, a publicly held company or other, you know, cybersecurity is a big issue. IT is just a part of doing business. Of course, they're going to spend on it. They have money to do so. Mm-hmm. But there's some information in your story where you write about these NGOs, small organizations that they are three times more likely to be targeted by hackers than large companies. And about 60% of those groups shut down within 6 months of an attack. So they are very vulnerable, and their organization is really at stake of being shut down if they get hacked. I had no idea, and I didn't think about how vulnerable they are and that they don't have the access to either spend to protect their information or their organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's two things here. So these specific NGOs that the Berkeley Clinic are working with, mm-hmm. is like that they tend to be super high risk because they are doing things like anti-human trafficking, abortion work, you know, political kind of NGOs. And so they're super high risk, and they are highly at risk of being hacked because of the work they do, because of prying governments and the criminal gangs. Then on top of that, there's also the risk that is to small businesses generally across the US. And because we hear so much about really large scale hackers going after, you know, publicly listed companies, because the return on, you know, if they do a ransomware attack, and if they try and get like 5% of their quarterly earnings, it's a huge sum. But we never really talk about how, like, the scale of the smaller organizations that are being hacked, and mm-hmm. the returns are smaller for the hackers, but it's easier for them to get in. And cumulatively, they're making tons of money off the smaller organizations, which are less likely to be protected, which are less likely to have cyber insurance, and then, as the stats show, are more likely to fold as a result of that attack.
Margie, this isn't really featured in the story, but I'm just curious, is this something that the sources you spoke with think they could scale in a tangible way? Do they anticipate trying to roll out resources that make the education on how to do this a little bit more accessible?
I think it's something they'd love to do. And in this example, what the students are doing is essentially, it's free consultancy. So they're not providing any technology themselves. And I think that a lot of what the students go on to do is they become consultants. They're working, like one of my sources, Rachel, she now works at Deloitte. And they're kind of, I guess they're hoping that they could maybe bring what they learn with them and pay it back. In terms of scaling it, at the moment, there's actually, Berkeley is one of several clinics that have actually popped up, and there is a consortium that they've all pulled together, and there are donors who are feeding some money into that. And I think they're hoping that that will expand and that will get bigger, and we'll see more community-based pro bono work as kind of we see more cyber attacks happening and we see the cost of cybersecurity software rising. So in terms of scaling, it wouldn't be a scale like we would see with a product, but I think in terms of people getting involved and trying to help, and maybe seeing private companies put some funding behind it, that we might see scale.
So the Travis Project, obviously, that was a really interesting one. I'm curious what other organizations, the clinic at Berkeley and beyond, who else are they attempting to assist with these efforts?
Yeah, so interestingly, each clinic, so they're attached to universities, and each university has their own, I guess, theme probably isn't the right word, but the type of organization they do. So Berkeley was these high risk NGOs. I think MIT was doing more community focused, like local healthcare and government. And so they kind of specialize on that. But Berkeley specifically, I also spoke to the administrative manager at the abortion clinic in the San Francisco General Hospital, who has worked with them. They've also done other women's health organizations. They also work with, there was a organization in Guatemala, which was kind of more of a political NGO, so it's quite international. And I think that what really struck me was how this could be applied to pretty much any vertical, as you know, it impacts, it's not just the NGOs, it's there are small businesses around the country which really need this help, and they're not getting it and they can't afford it. And
so, we read about all the ransomware hacks that have gone down, and it's like hospitals, schools, private companies, it's like take your pick, and like anytime it happens, it is your nightmare. And then to think like you don't have the funding that you need to actually defend yourselves from these things. And especially if you're attempting to do good work like these folks, it's like, it's an amazing conundrum.
Right. The concept of that, like what you're doing is all of a sudden shut down and then maybe you can't even recover from it. So it's really, really concerning. The other thing I thought was interesting, Margie, and maybe because we've been talking a lot about earlier on our broadcast, Maddie and I got into how women participation, certainly in the prime earning, their participation post pandemic is at a record high. And I just think about the tight labor force that is forcing also companies or folks that maybe might not have in another environment leaned on students to help them. They're like, I'm okay with it because it's actually kind of solving a problem because there's just not enough cybersecurity officials, right, to go out there and do it.
Right, totally. I mean, the idea itself sounds terrifying, setting a load of students on your kind of cybersecurity practice, which is meant to be, you know, the most, well, cybersecurity people would argue is the most important part of your business. But when you don't have the people to help you, that you know, when you can't afford it, you'll take what you're given. And it turns out that actually these students are really, really good, and they are being trained by the best in class. So the tutors that they have are people who've worked in the industry for years, and they want to give back, and they know what the problem is. And oftentimes these problems aren't really expensive to solve, but sometimes people are being sold things that, you know, they're being told you need to pay a certain amount for this. A lot of it comes down to cyber hygiene, but with the kind of growing threat and the sophistication in which cyber criminals are, you know, evolving, we just need, people need refreshers quite often on how to, you know, privately message, access controls over your files, who can see what. It can be quite simple stuff, but unless you have someone who knows telling you that, you know, you don't know until you don't know, and then you've been hacked, and that's a problem. So I think
7 weeks of training. I love this, right? Power of backups, importance of privacy controls and software, the operation of virtual private networks, and how to assemble it all into a cybersecurity plan. 7 weeks. And they can then take on clients. I love it. It's just a really smart story and just people figuring out how to get it done. Margie, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Margie Murphy, cybersecurity reporter at Bloomberg News. She is there on Zoom in San Francisco. Jill Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week here in studio. This story in the upcoming new issue of Business Week due out on newsstands on Thursday, online already and on the Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Radio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
The world was once in love with them, and thanks to a count and his IP, an industry was created until, of course, disaster struck in 1937. Fast forward and you add in a multi-billionaire tech titan, the airship, it is back with more on the past, the present, and the future of lighter-than-air vehicles. A story in the new double issue of Bloomberg Business Week. With us is Ashley Vance, joining us on the phone, along with the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber, here in studio. Joel, sounds like this is a story that's been in the works for a little bit.
More than a little bit. And Ashley had just an inside look at what is just an incredible story. You mentioned airship. So we're going to talk about an effort to modernize that airship. That takes a lot of money, a lot of patience, and a lot of time. And it really starts decades ago with the Hindenburg and the disaster that was then. And so much attention, basically, you know, has always been on that. And everybody's probably just forgotten that once upon a time, there was hope that the airship, the era of the airship, mm-hmm. was going to be a thing. And we might be on the brink of it again. Okay, Ashley, I've set that up and been kind of long-winded with it. I want you to tell us how you found out about Sergey Brin's attempt to bring back the airship.
Yeah, well, this one's a bit of a long and winding story. I broke the first story on this around like 2017. I had heard rumors that Sergey was building this secret airship near my house in Mountain View, California, at NASA Ames, and we published that story, and Sergey was not happy about it. and then some years passed, and I met the man who's actually doing the building, this guy named Al Weston, who's an aerospace engineer, and he forgave me for disclosing his secret and then actually let me watch the construction of this airship over the last couple of years. And in next month, in June, it comes out of the hangar for the first time. The first craft is called the Pathfinder 1.
And the company that Al Weston's CEO of, Lighter Than Air, obviously the thing with the Hindenburg was that it went up in flames, went down in flames, to be more specific. What is different about this attempt?
Well, so you're right. I mean, we have this glorious period from kind of like the early 1900s, even, you know, the Hindenburg, I think, was 1937, and even past there, where we actually, various countries produced hundreds of airships. They were used for tourism and the military, all kinds of stuff. The Hindenburg disaster put an end to the tourism things, and then airplanes kind of ended the rest. And nobody has attempted, you know, we see blimps and whatever, hot air balloons, but nobody's attempted to make a proper airship with a rigid structure, which is what allows them to get really large and carry lots of stuff and lots of people. No one's tried to do that for 85 years. And so this is the first attempt. As you mentioned, Joel, it takes a lot of money, and then you know, they've tried to modernize the whole idea, given that it's been 85 years.
And so how does it accomplish the lighter than air, right? Because previously that was hydrogen. We know that's explosive. So the magic is?
Yeah, this time it's helium, which has the benefit of not being flammable. It is a lot more expensive.
Seems like a key ingredient there, right?
Right. I mean, you know, there are people now, the Hindenburg is very complicated, the theories on what exactly went wrong there. There are people who think you could build these with hydrogen and do it much more safely. But obviously there's, you know, all these years later, this sticks in people's heads. But this one's helium. It's enormous. It's bigger than a football field in length. I've seen it many times, and this time it's made, instead of wood or metal, it's made out of carbon fiber and titanium, so it's a lot lighter and sturdier than the airships of the past. And so this really is this modern take on one, and now obviously kind of goes searching for a purpose.
I guess I'm curious too about what's it like inside.
Yeah, well, this one, for the moment, it's, I would say, not super, super spectacular. It has a gondola. You, like, on the inside of the actual structure, it's amazing. You see this geometric pattern of all these carbon fiber tubes feeding into the titanium and all the electronics and everything that goes into this. The outside, it looks just like any kind of blimp or airship you might have seen before, and there's a gondola underneath that has room for a couple pilots and probably about 8 or 10 people. And this first one, the Pathfinder 1 from LTA, it's almost like a prototype to prove what they can do. They already have plans to make a much, much larger one as their second craft.
One thing, I wanted to ask you about Alan Weston and Sergey Brin. Like, how did these two guys get together?
It's
it's an odd pairing.
Yeah, you know? Right?
It was almost a marriage made through logistics. Google's headquarters are about 2 miles from NASA Ames, which is where the Pathfinder 1 is being built, NASA's Silicon Valley Center. And Al Weston, he had a career in the Air Force working on pretty top secret sort of projects like the Star Wars missile defense shields. And then he ended up at Ames for many years working on low-cost lunar landers and other space projects. And so they met just by way of things Google had been doing in concert with NASA and various projects, and they both struck up this kinship around airships. They both just really liked them. This is what this boils down to, is that Sergey Brin likes airships, and he wanted one.
So what are they going to use these for? Is it clear yet?
It is clear what they intend to use it for. I don't know if the business case is totally clear. Sergey maybe doesn't have to turn this into a profitable thing. He wants to use them to take tons of cargo. He's very into disaster relief. This is kind of where he focuses some of his money. So you'd fly tons of cargo into an area that maybe is hit by a hurricane that can't be reached very well by boats or planes, or the infrastructure's damaged, and you can drop an airship in there. There is a pretty strong case to be made that this is a greener form of shipping cargo than something like a plane, and possibly in some cases a ship or a train. But they can, these large airships that LTA is looking to build can carry hundreds of tons of stuff. And then far in the future, tourism might come back again with these kind of flying, somewhere between a cruise ship and a 5-star hotel in the sky. And you would take like a 2-day journey from London to New York and be able to walk around and open the windows and sit on a deck and have meals, you know, in class.
Sounds like somebody who actually went up in one and got to open up a window and get the experience. Take us to Germany, because one of my questions when I was reading this, I'm like, is this really a business? Take us to Germany and what's been going on there.
Right. So much of this airship pioneering was done by Count Zeppelin in Germany.
He's a real person, or was.
And he's left this legacy, oddly. A bunch of intellectual property that he came up with ended up as the fuel of like an aerospace and automotive empire in Germany. And the foundation behind this intellectual property donates millions of dollars to the city of Friedrichshafen, where I went, and they fund these tourist flights at a Zeppelin NT airship. It's smaller than the ones LTA is building. But yeah, for about $800, you can fly for 90 minutes and feel like a wizard. It's a strange experience.
Wait, you did it.
I did it. I did it for the story and for Hello World, my TV show. So, you know, it's very different to a plane or a helicopter, which can take off quite violently and suddenly. You just kind of slowly glide up, and then you've got some propulsion from these propellers, but you're also at the mercy of the wind, and you just kind of bob around. And there's no air pressure like in a plane where the cabin is pressurized. So you can just open the window, and you can stick your head out and see all the sights below. I felt like a dog up there.
I was going to say, how many times did they ask you to put your head back inside the
cabin? Stop it, sir. Sir, could you put your head back in?
I think our whole Hello World crew was laughing at me. I just had this huge smile on my face. I liked the window thing.
So where does it go from here? There's going to be this unveiling, and what comes next for LTA, lighter than air?
It's a pretty cool part of the story, I think. You know, the 100 years ago, Goodyear was the airship king in the United States, and most of that took place in Ohio. Sergey Brin has actually, his company, his family trust, has gotten taken over the old Goodyear air dock, which is a huge hangar in Akron, Ohio. And that's where their next vehicle, which is called Pathfinder 3, for some reason they just skipped Pathfinder 2, is going to come to life at this air dock in Akron. And there's still all these people who used to work for Goodyear, and there's a university there that has a bunch of archives and talent in this field. And so it's like a revival of this 100-year-old story. And oddly, Sergey Brin is at the center of it.
So you got to talk to him about his interest here, right?
I wish. Sergey saw my first story. He told me that he enjoys my writing, but that he didn't want to talk about his airship, and that was about 6 years ago. And I frequently ask him. He knows I've been in there. He knows I've been talking to Al. He just does not want to comment about the airship himself, and so it's kind of been me talking to Al Weston about Sergey's motivations and then talking to a bunch of employees there. I'm not sure why Sergey wants to be so secretive. You know, the cat is out of the bag, but there it is.
Well, there's a lot of money that he's put into this thing. And so I'm wondering, you know, like what's in it for him?
Part of it, I think he really does do all this humanitarian stuff. I think that's part of it. I think he really does just want an airship. You know, everybody's got a mega yacht. Not many of these billionaires. No
or a rocket or something like that.
Yeah, that is also worth mentioning here. You know a little bit about here. That. Yeah, you know, Elon's got the rockets. Like, you know, is this, how does this compare with a rocket, do you think?
Well, I mean, it's similar in terms of sort of the scale of this and the cost and the time it takes to make it. Yeah, I think you roll up to the party and everyone's showing pictures of their rockets or their mega yachts, and you're the only one with the airship photo. That's it's a claim to fame.
It is true. There's barely, if you're going for just like number of crazy things that can go in the air, fewer airships than there are rockets, right?
Yeah, but I think this is like the worry. So many people are really into airships. They've seen a bunch of startups come and go. It always ends up costing more money. And so people are excited in this field, but they're really concerned that Sergey loses interest as this just keeps costing.
But once he goes up, right, that's going to change everything. He'll have his head out the window. It's, you know, he's going to double down on it.
I think that's the hope for the guys at LTA is that Sergey just falls in love with it all over again. This has taken a number of years longer, I think, than he expected, and it's up over $250 million, probably quite a bit above that. That was the best figure I could get. So I'm sure he wants to see a bit more progress, but he has acquired this facility in Ohio and is pushing on.
Are there dates like on the calendar, like there's going to be some big press conference and we're going to get to see a launch of it? Or I'm just curious, like kind of what's on your radar of what's next from the company and from them?
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen it flying as such as you can in a hangar. I mean, this hangar's giant, so it can kind of bob around. But in early June, after our story runs, I'm sure LTA is going to put out an announcement to invite some other press to see it come out of the hangar for the first time. It doesn't immediately soar or anything like that. There's a lot of ground testing that's going to take place over months. It's got to get certified by the FAA. The pilots have to be certified and all that. So it's going to be some time before it's soaring in the air. But it's all completed now. And yes, it's going to make its big entrance into the world here any day.
All right, I'm just going to get a little teaser. There's, Al Weston in a gorilla suit, but maybe people have to check that one out. It's a little bit of a rumor. This is really fascinating. When we think about kind of where things are going to go and how things are moving around, you know, Ashley, you're always on it. So thank you so much for sharing this with us. Ashley Vance, of course, he is Bloomberg Businessweek features writer, joining us along with the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, Joel Weber, and the story in the upcoming new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Businessweek podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
So about a week ago, Bloomberg News was out with a story. It was about how airlines' first-class makeovers are giving the rich hotel rooms in the sky. That means carriers are investing billions of dollars to upgrade cabins. They've got sofas, double beds, TVs, desks, wardrobes, minibars, and in some cases, Matt Mailer, walk-in showers.
That's awesome.
I know.
I think that rules.
Sign me up. It's like your flight you're going to take out over the weekend, right?
I'm flying to Detroit over the weekend. It'll probably be on an incredibly uncomfortable narrow-body jet in coach.
Okay, sorry about that. Well, listen, if that doesn't cut it, though, these upgrades that some are enjoying in first class, you can always buy your own private jet, including you, Matt Miller. So let's get into that with our next guest, Janine Iannarelli. She is founder and president of Par Avion. It's an international business, aircraft sales, and a marketing firm. And she joins us once again on Zoom in Houston, Texas. Janine, nice to have you back here on Bloomberg. It's been a little while. Tell us about the market and what you're seeing right now and how everything has really kind of settled in post-pandemic.
Settled in. Well, the term that you're hearing oft used among the trade is a return to normalization. And it certainly feels that way now that we're through Q1 and well into Q2 as compared to the last 2 years. Whereas in late 21 and all of 22, we were saying, who knew a pandemic could be good for business aviation? But it was. And now that we're on the backside of that, we see, I personally see, and I hear it echoed by my peers, a pronounced slowdown in the number of inquiries, the level of activity, and prices are starting to correct.
So is that because, I mean, I guess during the pandemic, if you had enough money to fly not just privately, but more importantly, separately from everyone else, you did that so that you wouldn't get sick. Now, maybe people are less worried about that and willing to, you know, as Carol said, you know, airlines, commercial airlines are putting your own room on the flight. So you might as well just take that instead of buying a G550 or whatever it is.
Well, there's still a huge difference between commercial airline travel and that of flying on your own aircraft. I mean, let's just talk about the convenience. First of all, there's not necessarily a deadline by which time they're going to close the door and you've missed your flight. Secondly, it's not the restrictive sort of feel with business or private aviation as it has with commercial. In commercial, you're sharing the space still with dozens, if not hundreds, of fellow passengers that are trampling down the same aisle, using the same restrooms, taking advantage of all the, well, limited open space that you have. Whereas when people gravitated towards private aircraft during the pandemic, it was exactly that, creating a health corridor. So they knew who they were mingling with, what they were touching from the moment they left their home till they reached their destination. You are correct. There is a slide back towards commercial travel, but I would say most of the draw. Sorry.
No, well, you know what I wanted to jump in? Because I am curious. You said normalization, pronounced slowdown. I am curious what that means in your business. Is it down 50%? Is it down 40%? I mean, I'm looking at your website, you know, what have I got here? A Cessna Citation, a Bombardier Global 7500. You're talking about planes that go for what? Tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars. These are not inexpensive items. And I'm just curious, what's a slowdown in this space look like?
Well, slowdown is probably, let's talk activity. Whereas before you could even get the airplane to market, you had a ready buyer for it. It was gone. The advertising was just done to sort of serve as a means by which to get other people to call in. Today, we are now seeing lead times, or I should say, bring the aircraft to market and you're going to sit on the market 90 to 120 days on average with most of the aircraft. I would say the flight or the decline in activity is being felt at the top end for sure, as well as at the entry level, the $2 to $7 million business jet that people jumped on in a panic, in a frenzy buying, I would say, through late 20, right up until Q3 22.
Right.
That's all gone away.
Huh. By the way, in terms of, you know, owning a private jet and using it, how many people actually fly their own? Do you have clients like that?
A few, but very few. That is the small percentage of the entire, let's say, ownership pool that actually pilot their own aircraft.
So
at
what,
least in the category of airplane I work with.
What are the hottest ones that you sell? What's the private jet? If I, you know, have some liquidity event and I'm all of a sudden holding a billion cash, and I come to you and
you
say,
mean when you sell your Bitcoin?
Yeah. Janine, give me the hottest it jet that you've got. What's the one that everybody wants?
that global 7,500 that you're taking a good look at. If you come into $1 billion, that is the aircraft for you. You can go anywhere in the world quite comfortably. But the other side of the IT jet, let's call it an IT sector, is the midsize, super midsize. Popular airplane, perfect size, ideally suited for continental U.S. travel, and the charter operators love it.
You know what I'm curious too about? I think the last time we talked, and again, it was a few years ago, I think cross-border was a big thing for you, and so were entrepreneurs. Who is buying today? And I'm curious, entrepreneurs made me think Silicon Valley Bank or Slowdown, if that's had an impact.
Well, tech sector certainly has seen a slowdown and decline of inquiries coming from that particular industry. But entrepreneurs are still my sweet spot. Remember, there are entrepreneurs doing many different things. And one market declines, another one rises. One industry declines, another rises. In the aircraft sales world, we make money coming and going in economic cycles. As far as the cross-border, that's starting to pick up, but still lagging behind demand within the United States.
Janine, what if I only have, like, I don't know, 50, 60 million bucks, but I have a few friends with 50 or 60 million bucks? Do you recommend people going in on a jet, or would you steer someone away from that idea? I mean, does it really make sense to buy your own jet? Isn't it better to be able to lease it out occasionally?
Well, what you buy is driven by your need, for sure. How many hours per month you anticipate you'll be flying, what's the distances you're going to be traveling. While partnership in aircraft is not uncommon, it doesn't always work because you have conflicting needs or conflicting schedules. So if you had three friends and each of you had $50 million apiece, sure, pool and buy one jet that might facilitate some of the trips, but ultimately I think you'll find you each need your own.
You know, I do wonder too, Janine, like there are weird things that we sometimes look at for global economic indicators. And I'm curious about what you are seeing in your business. Does it says to you that a recession is on the horizon, or how would you describe kind of the economic outlook?
The big R word. So that's obviously been something that's been discussed within the trade since the middle of last year, because we know it's looming. An economic cycle is inevitable. And we've been through a boom period in our business. And I would say that business jets historically have been a pretty good leading indicator of things to come. I think the waters are a bit muddied at this time, that we're not predicting what's coming next. The slowdown that we're feeling, I think, was inevitable as a result of several things. One, the 100% bonus depreciation going away at the end of last year. The pandemic frenzy buying is pretty much over. Most everyone made their selections, got their deals done. And now that's why we call it a return to normalization, normal turn time on the aircraft. The number of inquiries are equalizing. And, you know, as prices slide, it's going to stimulate demand once again. And I have to say that I'm not sure prices are going to slide dramatically. They're going to correct slightly. And if these prices slid to 2019 level, is that still a win for everybody?
I hear you. I think about that all the time myself, actually.
What's that?
If we drop just back to 2019 levels, is that bad or is that a win? We've gone through this incredible pandemic.
Right.
It doesn't seem like it's such a horrible stat. Anyway, Janine, great having you on. I always love to get a check on the private jet industry. Janine Iannarelli, they are founder and president of Par Avion.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
It's the official, unofficial start of the summer. Our Bluebird Pursuits team is back with its annual summer travel guide on this Memorial Day weekend. And we've got two great voices to help us put together an itinerary for a potential escape from the grind. Listen up, everybody. Joining us now are Bloomberg Pursuits editor Chris Rouser and travel editor Nikki Eckstein. They're here to tell us where to go, what to do, and even what type of luggage to use. And they're giving some love to my home state of New Jersey. Chris, everyone seems to be wanting to travel right now, I feel like. So how did you guys think about putting together summer travel and what you wanted to cover?
So we cover travel all year round, of course. And but summer travel last summer and this summer are going to be crazy. Everyone wants to travel. We're back to above pre-pandemic levels. But when we put together this summer travel package, we're always thinking, okay, what's different about summer travel? Like, because you feel like maybe I get more of a break. People really aren't going to bug you while you're gone. I can go somewhere really far. I can do something really different. And we put together a package of unexpected things, places that are changing, and modes of travel that you may not have thought about, like our opener, which is about walking trips. It's not hiking trips. It's walking.
Well, and let's talk about it, because I have to say, and Chris, that the Berkshires are so beautiful. I used to go up there pretty regularly in the fall. It is stunning. So tell us a little bit about this story.
So Matt Kronsberg, who's one of our favorite writers, had the idea to do a walking trip story because there are these two books that came out about walking trips. One's called American Ramble. It's by Neil King Jr. And one's called Walking with Sam by Andrew McCarthy, the actor and wine writer.
It is the actor. Yeah, I wasn't sure. Yeah. Okay.
And Matt called up Andrew McCarthy, actually, and said, "What, do you have any advice?" And Andrew McCarthy's advice was, "Just go. Just go. Just go. Don't think about it. Just go." He must have said it 10 times in 4 minutes. And so Matt called us and said, "Okay, I'm going to go." And we and Nikki can tell you like how we kind of figured landed on the Berkshires.
All right. So Nikki, come on in. How did he land on the Berkshires?
Yeah. So Matt was like, "I want to do a walking trip. I'm inspired. I've read these books. I'm drinking the Kool-Aid." And I was like, "Great, Matt, where are you going to go?" And he said, "Well, maybe I could do something near Washington, D.C. Maybe I can do something in California. Maybe I could do something." And, you know, the whole board was wide open to him. And I said, "Okay, let's figure out what the route would be." And let me tell you, walking is not something that is infrastructurally set up in this country for these long distance routes the way that it might be in Europe with like the Camino de Santiago or the Transcaucasian Trail. These are all kind of large walking routes that are deliberately set up that way. You have the Great Walks of Australia. Not so much in the U.S. where towns aren't clustered together in walking distance often. We stumbled upon this woman who created a company called Berkshire Camino, inspired by the Camino de Santiago in Spain. And she helped him create an itinerary of about 50 miles over 4 days throughout the Berkshires. And we said, "Oh my God, this is perfect. And the Berkshires are beautiful. And where else do you want to be in the summer other than lush mountains with beautiful artsy towns with great ice cream shops? It's just the perfect all-American summer destination." Yeah.
Everybody's ears perk up. Ice cream? Wait, ice cream's on the tour? But it is like, I feel like one of those areas in the country, especially it's not that far from New York City, and you can kind of breathe once you get there. Talk to us about some of the places that Matt and his wife visited.
Well, can I tell you one place that they didn't visit? They didn't visit an airport, which to me is like, just thinking about Memorial Day coming up, and there's like this stat that is lodged in my brain right now that 17 million people are going to be in U.S. airports this weekend. So he did not go through an airport. The places that he walked through were these beautiful country roads, and he walked into this like little itty bitty town called Lee, where he found a diner that inspired a Norman Rockwell painting. And he walked to a dairy where the cows are free range and then are milked right on site. And that milk is turned into sweet cream ice cream. And, you know, it was just bucolic small town destinations away from crowds, surrounded by nature. And he stayed at really cute, artsy, upscale lodges, like Little Cat Lodge, for instance, is a relatively new opening that we're all pretty excited about. It's owned by the same guy that owns Mile End, the really cool Montreal bagel shop here in New York City. He's got outposts in Brooklyn and in Midtown, and he opened this little lodge. And so he stayed in cool places like that. So that's really the difference between walking and hiking is you don't have to camp out. You don't have to sleep in a tent. It's not really about technical gear and uphill. It's like bucolic walking staying at lovely little lodges.
It's so beautiful, and I highly recommend everybody check it out, the pictures, and there's so much detail. I also love that there was one point after a full day of walking, and they're like trying to figure out dinner, and he's like, let's walk a little bit more, let's go find dinner.
Let's walk three miles to dinner.
Right, like it was kind of wild. All right, let's move along to Mallorca. Am I saying it correctly?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool. Tell me what's going on there, Nikki, when it comes to, because it feels like it was an area where people would go to party big time, but it's kind of going through a little bit of a change.
So have you been to Mallorca, Carol?
I have not been to Mallorca.
You have not? Okay, put it on your list.
Okay.
It is one of the most beautiful places I've ever been. And it's true. The majority of people who have gone to Mallorca in the past, like totally dominating their tourism scene, are Europeans, Brits, Germans, people who are relatively short-range distances away. Mallorca is an island right off the coast of Spain, one of the Balearics, and it is defined by beautiful cove-like beaches and these dramatic Tramuntana mountains. And most people stay on the fringes of the island, relatively near the capital of Palma. It's where you might get cruise ships docking. It's where you get a lot of all-inclusive resorts. The smart way to do Mallorca, in my opinion, is to bypass all of that and go to the resorts that are in the mountain towns. But there's only been a few in the past. Very high-end, very lovely, harder to find. It's not the easiest and most intuitive trip to plan. That's changing as the island and its tourism board start to actually enact restrictions that limit the activity of cruise and all-inclusive business and really focus on highlighting the cultural and culinary offerings of the island that are often scattered in these beautiful mountain towns. That's kind of what's happening.
It looks stunning. I do like the idea that too, that the government, as you said, like limiting the number of cruise ships, limiting the number of drinks that, that folks can have just to kind of give it a certain feel. I'd love to spend more time on it, but I got to go to, because you guys wrap up with Glamour on the Jersey Shore, which kind of breaks my heart a little bit, but because I am a Jersey girl. But it is amazing what is going on along the coast. Like, Chris, you go to the Jersey Shore.
Yes, my in-laws are on the Jersey Shore, and Nikki lives in New Jersey. So we are already fans, but there is a ton of development happening all up and down the shore, hundreds of millions of dollars, a lot in Atlantic City. You're going to see Atlantic City coming back.
Are they really coming back? Because I can't tell you how many times we've done this story. I've gone down and done remotes there and, you know, new hotels and casinos and, you know, and then where's...
People have tried.
Yeah. Is it different this time around?
This feels different because it's not just one project at a time. It's a real amalgamation of developments. I mean, more than $1 billion have been pumped into Atlantic City in the last year.
Wow.
A billion. I mean, more than $1 billion. It's eye-popping. And it's a team effort, really, in Atlantic City between a lot of major players and also a lot of independents. And granted, we didn't have time to go through every single development in this story because it is the amount of news is tremendous. But there are, you know, small local residents doing really enterprising, small businessy type things. And then there are the bigwig casinos, the MGMs, the Hard Rocks, the Caesars of the world, pumping in mega, mega, mega money to restore entire tracts of Atlantic City at a time. So I think you will see a rising sophistication there that hasn't been seen in decades.
And there's also, you know, just to cover the rest of the shore, all the way down in Cape May, they're doing a lot of development on the ferry terminal there. There's going to probably be a big new resort being built in the next couple of years. Then further up in Bradley Beach, really cute hotel. Asbury Park has tons of great restaurants. I was just there. Really cool hotels. And there's just a lot. There's a lot of like chic stuff happening.
Well, and I think what's interesting is it's not just about gambling or casinos anymore, and that's maybe the difference. Final thought, go ahead, Nikki.
Yeah, well, the funny thing that I kept hearing while I was there reporting the story was we're getting people from the Hamptons. People are tired of the traffic to the Hamptons. They want an easier place to go. They want a little bit more fresh air.
I love it.
People are swapping the Jersey Shore for the Hamptons, rather the Hamptons for the Jersey Shore.
It could happen. And there's also a great piece on different types of luggage if you're planning holiday or business travel, some different choices for everybody. So I highly recommend everybody check it out. All right. Thank you, guys. Bloomberg Pursuits editor Chris Rouser and travel editor Nikki Eckstein with our guide to summer travel. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, more on summer travel and why globetrotters can expect the busiest and most expensive season since prior to COVID. That's coming up. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekdays from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.
iHeartRadio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube.
You can also listen live to our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right, so we've talked a little about retail, which gives you a great idea in terms of what's going on in the consumer world. Another thing is travel, and it also tells us kind of what's going on in the economy. So let's get to it with Haley Berg. She's lead economist at the mobile travel app Hopper, and she joins us on the phone in New York City. Haley, good to have you here. Tell us what you are seeing when it comes to the travel industry as we head into the summer travel season.
We're headed into the busiest time of year for travel, and really we're expecting this to be the biggest summer for travel since pre-pandemic. International travel has completely opened up since last year, and domestic travel remains very strong, especially as prices are down about 20% from this time last year. All in, it looks like it's going to be a busy summer and an extremely expensive summer for those travelers who are headed abroad, but they're not being held back by fares.
Yeah, we actually heard from Jen Bartoshis. We were talking to our Bloomberg Intelligence retail analyst, and she said, you know, middle class to wealthier people are shopping for food at cheaper stores so they can still afford to spend money on discretionary items. I guess travel is one of those. You don't see anybody holding back? I mean, is nobody balking at the incredibly high prices?
What we're really seeing at Hopper is travelers are taking that same or a slightly larger travel budget and trying to stretch it further. So maybe previously they've been taking one trip a year. Now they're taking two trips on the same budget. So that means they're engaging in deal-seeking behavior. You know, more than 50% of our Hopper customers are booking the cheapest flight that's available to them at the time that they're searching. We're seeing them check prices about 50% more often, even as they plan trips more last minute. So though travelers are still spending and taking more trips, they are finding ways to stretch that budget quite a bit further.
So talk to us about some numbers. Bloomberg, we love to hear about numbers and percentage changes. So give me an idea if you're heading from New York over to Europe, pick your city or whatever. What are we looking for in terms of airfares?
Average airfare from the U.S. to anywhere in Europe is about $1,200 right now. There are some destinations direct from New York City as low as $800 or $900 round trip. But overall, that $1,200 ticket price on average, that's up 37% from this time last year and in 2019. That's about $320 more per ticket for travelers who are headed to Europe, which is the top destination for summer vacations.
Oh, where are they going in Europe? Is it just in general the continent, or are people going specifically to Spain or Italy or Greece?
Paris.
We typically see London, Paris, and Rome are the top three, the ultimate trifecta. They're definite destinations for tourists who are just dipping their toe in Europe. But we do also see demand to some of these smaller cities, especially in Italy. You know, Sicily is popular coming off the success of the White Lotus, but we've also seen Venice and Milan.
That's really a thing, right? White Lotus, it's really a thing in terms of travel?
It absolutely is. We call it set jetting. It happened with Croatia and Iceland when Game of Thrones was released. It's happening
with
Yellowstone.
People died, you know, in White Lotus. I'm just saying, it was a little eerie.
It was great, though. I loved both seasons. I will say, pro tip to those looking to travel to Europe over the summer, it is extremely hot in Southern Europe. If you want to go to Sicily in August, I don't want to be with you because you are going to be pouring with sweat. I would much rather be in Scandinavia in August because it's so hot. The Spaniards don't even go outside. They just sit inside and sleep all day, and then at night they go in the pool.
That's why September and October are actually the best bet for travel to Europe. You'll pay as much as 30% less than you will to go in June or July. Huh. Temperatures will be better. And keep in mind, Americans are on vacation all summer. Europeans often go on multi-week vacations in August. So if you're going in August, you're going to be facing crowds of tourists from around the world. September is going to be lighter crowds, less expensive for accommodations and airfare.
So what's your advice for folks who want to travel?
Plan ahead if possible. So right now you're booking way too late if you want to go somewhere internationally this summer. You are going to pay quite a bit more and be flexible. So if you can plan ahead to go this fall, get lower prices, fly midweek if possible. You'll save about $50 to $100 on domestic airfare, $150 to $200 on international, and fly early in the day. Delays, cancellations, twice as likely to hit you if you depart after 8 a.m. So there is something to taking that first flight out of the day on a Monday or a Tuesday. It will save you some stress. It will save you some money as well.
What about Airbnbs? What's your verdict on, you know, we went to Austin for the MotoGP a couple weeks ago and hotels were like a grand. We found an Airbnb that was less than half the price and it was pretty good. I mean, no one comes to change your sheets every day, but it was nice. And, you know, with the extra money, we were able to go to more expensive restaurants for dinner.
We can send you rental homes. Extremely popular, especially around destinations at the beach or Disney. Disney's hugely popular for vacation homes. Often larger groups of family members are there, and it really helps bring down the cost of maybe getting multiple hotel rooms. But keep in mind that those rental homes can book out really far in advance, especially in popular destinations. And hotel rooms, on the other hand, drop in price when you book at the last minute. So weigh your options. If you're looking for more space, rental homes can definitely be more economical. But at times, if you're booking last minute, hotels, you can get a fabulous deal, especially in big cities.
All right. We're going to leave it there. We're going to let you go get some water because I'm a little worried about you. Haley, come on back soon. We'd love to continue with you at a future date. Haley Berg, lead economist over at Hopper, joining us on the phone in New York City.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast.
Available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern
on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app.
You can also watch us live on Bloomberg Quick Take every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox president Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.